Judge Berzon,
yes.
You're with us?
I am, thank you.
Good. We'll call Deborah J. Anderson versus City of Long Beach.
May I please the court, Smithy Coates, on behalf of the defendants. The court is aware this case involves a warrantless arrest of Ms. Anderson in her residence. The officers have two ways by which, and a subsequent entry as well. The officers have two grounds which they urge that the district court was wrong in granting summary judgment to the plaintiffs on the issue of the lawfulness of the arrest and the entry. And again, there are two ways. First is, of course, that the officers were properly there to serve an arrest warrant on Mr. Smith based upon information they had that he was residing there. And the second ground is that, even putting that aside, that when Ms. Anderson appeared at what the defense contended was the doorway, she appeared to be under the influence of a controlled substance. They placed her under arrest while she was in the doorway and they were outside. She then retreated into the residence and they then went inside to complete the arrest under the Van Eaton case of this court. I'll turn first to the warrant issue because that boils down to the question of whether they had reason to believe that Mr. Smith was a resident in Ms. Anderson's home on November 3rd, and whether he was present at the time that they were there to execute the warrant. District court found plaintiff entitled to summary judgment because he believed that there was not sufficient evidence for them to really believe that Mr. Smith was residing in the residence at the time. And I see the district court flatly erred, given the not sufficient quantity, but more important, the quality of the evidence that the officers had. Now, the reason they believe that Smith was there was because Smith was having an ongoing problem with an ex-girlfriend, Ms. Sunderman. And, in fact, much of these problems stem from the fact that there were numerous restraining orders against Mr. Smith based upon his conduct with Ms. Sunderman. And he was calling her, leaving harassing messages despite restraining orders and the like. Ms. Sunderman, who is in a position to know because she was having these repeated conversations and messages from Mr. Smith, knew that he was residing with Ms. Anderson at her home, and that's what she told these officers. And in fact,
how does she know that?
She was having telephone conversations with Mr. Smith. And this is, we're talking probably about a 6-week window period between these conversations, which I think are mid-September, and then the arrest is November 3rd. The harassing messages are through September through October, and in fact, based upon her information before, on I think it was October 9th, the officers had served a restraining order on Smith at the Anderson residence. Now there's plenty of a bone of contention as to whether there's an additional fact in the record that at the time Smith signed a proof of service or an acceptance of service on the restraining order listing Anderson's home as his residence.
From what I can see, he didn't.
I'm sorry?
From what I can see, he didn't. There's a document in the record which is the proof of service, and it's not signed by him.
Are we talking about the October 9th restraining order?
I thought it was, and I thought that it was signed by the officer.
Because I believe the testimony that we have, well, we're talking about the acceptance of service. I think we're talking about preliminary hearing testimony. The evidence that plaintiffs put in the record on that fact, even if it's a disputed issue as to whether he acknowledged at the time and expressly stated it's his residence.
That's a different issue, but who signed it is not in dispute. He did not sign it, right?
I'm sorry, excuse me?
What he said may be in dispute, but what he signed is not in dispute.
What the officer signed. That I think the proof of service the court's looking at may be the one that the officer signed. I think we're
right.
Talking about that there was another, an acceptance of servants, and that, I believe, is through testimony of preliminary hearing. Plaintiffs debate whether that's properly in the record for summary judgment. We have arguments in the brief as to why we think it is, because it was submitted by plaintiffs. But I think even putting that aside, that you have the fact that the officers, as of October 9th, based on Sunderland's information, know that he's residing with Anderson. I mean, they go there and they serve him there.
How do they know that?
How do we know that on October?
They served him there?
They served him. Sunderland said, you will find him there. He's driving a car. He's residing with Anderson. Go to her house. You will find him there. That's why they served him there on October 9th. I mean, we have a chain of events here. I mean,
so they found him there and served him on October 9th.
On October 9th. We know that.
Okay.
And the officer's testimony is that they, you know, they had other information. I mean, Sunderman continued to tell them he's residing with Anderson.
So what other information? They have Sunderman saying on October 9th that he's residing with Anderson. What else do they have? This is November 3rd. What do they have saying that he was residing with Anderson on November 3rd?
The conversations with Sunderman, just what Sunderman tells them. They didn't do surveillance, didn't do observation. I don't think they're required to do that. Again, it's not necessarily the quantity of evidence. It's the quality of it. I mean, they have
probable informed. Cause, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, they need reasonable. They don't need probable cause. They only have to have a reasonable belief he's there. I think under this Court's cases and under the Supreme Court's decision in Seagold, it's not probable cause to believe he's there. It's just reasonable grounds.
Believe he's there, or believe he resides there. Aren't there two issues here?
There's two issues, exactly. Okay. One is there's reasonable cause to reside there, and then at the time you actually serve the warrant, you have to have reason to believe that he's actually there at the time you're there to serve it. The reasonable belief that he's actually there is based upon the information from Sunderman that he'd been driving the car, using it to go to work. They go after work hours. Car is there. That's what they base their assumption that Smith is there on November 3rd at that time. So the reasonable belief is that he resides there is from Sunderman. The reasonable belief that he's there presently at the time is based on the information from Sunderman and the presence of the car.
But didn't we say that reasonable belief entails the same protection and reasonableness inherent in probable cause?
I don't think that the Court's talking about the dispute in the Perez case. Because it's not one and the same. The Supreme Court has kind of made it clear that it's not one and the same either in these circumstances. It's not probable that he's there. It's just reasonable to believe that he's there. I think that's the standard.
You have a statement that says, we therefore find the reason to believe a reasonable belief standard of Payton should be read to entail the same.
I'm having trouble hearing.
Should be read to entail the same protection and reasonableness inherent in probable cause?
We're talking in...
But the reason to believe in Payton and Underwood should be so.
Reason to believe that he's present? Because I think there's a difference, because the Supreme Court draws a distinction between the reasonable cause and probable cause. I mean, it's merely reasonable to believe he's there. You don't have to make it probable to believe he's there. And I don't think that's consistent with this Court has decided these cases in terms of.
Probable cause doesn't mean more likely than not either.
I'm sorry?
Probable cause doesn't mean probable in the more likely than not sense either. Right?
Yeah. Probable cause just means that that a reasonable person would have a belief that when you're talking about arrest that the person has committed a crime and that a crime has been committed and this person has committed a crime.
Well, I think it's, like I said,
I don't really see the difference. So.
Well, I think it doesn't matter. Maybe the easiest thing is, I think we talked about it, but I don't think it matters in this case. I think that, you know, the substance of the information they have from Sunderman is the same under either standard. The quality of the evidence is such. You have someone that he's in constant contact with, you know, whether she wants to be or not. There are the numerous restraining orders and the like. Based upon that information from her, they had prior found him at exactly where they said they would find him, or she said they would find him. And
that's different from him being a resident. That's the whole point, isn't it, of the distinction between an arrest warrant for the person who lives there and the one person who doesn't live there.
In terms of...
The fact that he's studying is there is not the question. The question is, it's only the secondary question. The question is, does he reside there?
Yes, but the information why they find him there is because Anderson says Sunderman says he's living with Anderson. That's why they find him there on October 9th, based upon that information.
But that he had just been released from jail, right? And it was weeks earlier. So why did they have to go on that he was living there on November 3rd?
They have the same information. Sunderman tells them he's in contact with her. Through October, he's leaving these messages. I mean, she didn't want them, but he's leaving these messages. I mean, if there's anyone who's in a position to know where this man is, it's her. It's Sunderman.
Because he's calling her up and saying, I'm at this other person's house?
I'm sorry, I missed the last
one. Did the police have any specific information on any of these messages that had anything to do with where he was living?
The officers don't testify to specific information from Sunderman on that, no. They just have that we spoke with Sunderman. Sunderman said she'd had these messages, had these conversations, and all she said was he's living with Anderson. And I think, again, if you think they go there on October 9th, and he's there. And he's there. And I think we can go to the preliminary.
That's October 9th, but what about after that?
There's no indication he's changed his residence. I mean, I don't have any reason to believe he's not there after that. After having found him there based upon her information that he's residing there, I don't think there's anything that takes them off notice. They simply say that it's based on the information from Sunday. You know, could have been more detailed, yes. Could there have been surveillance, yes. But I don't think the case is really required that. I think it's reasonable to form that belief based upon the fact she's told you he's residing there.
Yeah. Well, what if they went back 3 months later? After the first visit,
you may get attenuated. I think the cases talk about that. But what I'm saying is we're talking about a fairly narrow period of time here, and we're talking about a quality of contact in terms of the person that you're getting this information from. This isn't even a confidential informant. I mean, this is somebody that knows Smith and who is in unwelcome contact with him. You know, and the fact that they actually served him with process there, a restraining order based upon her information prior, I think, confirms a reasonable, at least a reasonable belief on the officer's part that he's residing there.
Basically, what they have is somebody told him he was residing there, and several weeks before he'd been there. Period.
Yeah. Well, I don't think it, again, I don't disagree with the general characterization, but I don't think somebody, someone who intimately knows him, whether she wants to be intimately known by him or not. This isn't a confidential informant. It isn't some casual person on the street. It is someone that's having intimate conversations and messages with this guy, who this guy is trying to contact. So I think I take issue with just saying it's somebody. It's not. And that's, again, what I'm talking about. It's not the quantity of information. It's the quality of it, the person that's giving them this information, and the fact that it was confirmed on the 9th. And I again note, I mean, we do contend that it is properly in the record, the preliminary hearing testimony, where the officer says that he confirmed that that was his address. If the court looks at that, I think that at least makes it a genuine issue of fact. Because if he confirms that's his residence on October 9th, then I think that's got to go to the jury, even if, you know, plaintiff's making other arguments about, well, he had other reasons to believe he wasn't there. But
putting aside some other issues.
The other issues on the this is the other key issue is that even putting aside the validity of arresting Smith there with a warrant, that is Ms. Anderson's presence at the doorway under the influence of a controlled substance. I think this case falls directly in the Van Eaton line, Van Eaton and Santana, which is to say, when you come to the doorstep and you're in a public place and the doorway is considered a public place, that if the officer observes you committing a crime and places you under arrest while the officer is outside, then...
I accept that the defendant's undisputed facts say that when Farris voices suspicion, Ms. Anderson backed away from her doorway and into her residence, defendant Farris crossed the threshold and entered into Ms. Anderson's home to arrest her.
To complete the arrest.
It seems to me that your facts, the facts that you have... stipulated to are completely different from the ones you're now arguing.
No, I don't think they're stipulated. I think they announced the arrest out there and they go in to complete the arrest.
You didn't say you announced the arrest. You said you voiced your suspicion.
I don't think that's in the declaration.
And it's in the defendant's submission statement of uncontroverted facts and conclusions of law. On November 3rd, 1996, Barrett suspected from his Anderson's appearance that she might be under the influence of an illegal substance. When Farris voiced her suspicion, Ms. Anderson backed away from her doorway and into her residence. Defendant Farris crossed the threshold and entered into Ms. Anderson's home to arrest her. I don't understand how you can argue that
if you happened. Because if you look at the declaration testimony that is offered as supportive
fact.
It is, but the undisputed fact is set forth with declaration evidence both in our moving papers on the summary judgment and our opposing papers. The evidentiary citation for that is the testimony of the officers, wherein the officers specifically say, we announced the arrest, we arrested her while she was in the doorway, and she then retreated into the residence. That is what their evidence is. That is what is argued in the papers. I agree with you. I think that is clearly not well drafted. I will dead bang agree with you on that. But I think, as this Court has always looked at the substance of the evidence that's submitted.
We're supposed to ignore these statements of uncontroverted facts.
I think the Court has to take a look at the evidence that's submitted. I mean, I think it's error for a court. I think it's district court error if the Court just relies on that without looking at the actual evidence. And I think there's no question that the district court judge looked at the evidence here. He just disagreed with our interpretation of the law. He didn't disagree with you know.
He disagreed with agreed exactly with the evidence. I mean, his understanding of the evidence was exactly what that, what the material fact statement said it was, i.e. that she wasn't arrested until she was inside the house.
No, I don't think so. I think if you look at the district judge, what he was saying when he's making a decision, I think he concludes that the Van Eaton line of case has been eroded. He doesn't think it's a Van Eaton case. And, you know, I submit that when you have the, there's a clear factual dispute here between the defendants or between the parties as to where this arrest occurred. It's clearly set forth in the evidence as a dispute. It's argued in the papers as a dispute. I don't think plaintiffs acknowledge it. I think they disagree with our interpretation of what the law says.
Plaintiffs in their statement of undisputed facts, they saw the exact facts as being undisputed, which they had very good reason to do, which is that you stated they were undisputed.
But, like I said, the evidence submitted to dispute it, I think the argument you look at in the district court is the officers clearly contend they arrested her outside under Van Eaton in the doorway. That's what the evidence is. I don't think there's any dispute that that's the defendant's evidence here, is that she was arrested in the doorway and she backed up, and the bone of contention between the parties was whether or not you could arrest for a misdemeanor at the doorway and then have somebody retreat into the house. I mean, I think that's really what the split has been here, was whether Santana and Van Eaton encompass that situation. You know, I haven't heard plaintiffs argue the contrary, and I don't think the district court's judge order, at least when I've reviewed it, indicates that he believed that, that she was only arrested in the house. I think he just thinks that the Van Eaton line of cases is questionable. I think he's wrong in that regard, for the reasons that we set forth in the brief. I mean, I think there's a clear factual dispute on that.
Also, wasn't the statements in the preliminary hearings completely consistent with the statements I just read to you?
I'm sorry?
The statements that the testimony at the preliminary hearing was exactly consistent with the statement that I just read to you. Is that right?
It might be. I don't recall.
She was not arrested until she was inside the house.
I don't know. I don't recall. Again, that would make an issue of fact. It would defeat. I mean, we would have to.
You can't create your own issue of fact by contradicting yourself. You understand?
Well, it depends on who makes the statement. I mean, there are a number of defendants here. I know.
The same officer makes a statement, one statement at preliminary hearing, and then puts in an affidavit and says, oops, I guess I should have said it differently. Can he create an issue of fact by contradicting himself?
There are cases that say the district court can keep you from doing it, absolutely. I mean, I'm not going to dispute that. There are other cases that say it's for the jury, though. I mean, the cases go both ways on that, but you are right. I acknowledge that. But again, that's not what it's based on here. That's not what the district court found.
We're reviewing this de novo, and the question is, and the district court did have this statement of material fact, which was consistent with the preliminary hearing, and why did he do anything else?
Because he didn't choose to disregard the evidence. The evidence that you're talking about him disregarding, he didn't choose to disregard. I mean, when we look at what he said, his interpretation was based on how he viewed Van Eaton, and he just didn't think Van Eaton was still the law, essentially. That he didn't buy the fact that it was a doorway arrest, or that they had reason to go.
I'm now reading from the district court's tentative ruling, in which he says, Anderson was inside her home. Anderson was always inside the doorway to her home. And here after voiced his suspicions regarding her possible drug use, Anderson then retreated a few feet. And Farris then informed Anderson that she was under arrest, which is completely consistent with what I read you before. This is the district court's ruling. So I'm mystified about why you keep insisting that there's some other set of facts we should be operating on.
Well, again, because the evidence actually submitted, and the court has gone in the past on what the evidence is actually submitted to the district court and what it says. And the evidence the district court clearly draws.
But first, you tell me that the district court allows this other evidence, and I just read you what he understood the evidence to be.
Well, yeah, but he talks later. He discusses the declarations. He discusses this testimony. Again, and when he talks about, I think the bone of dispute for the district court judge was that he didn't buy the fact that Van Eaton allows you to arrest at the doorway if you're 3 feet from the doorway. I mean, it was very important in the district court where people were standing.
He claimed that Anderson was evading the officers, caused their entry into her residence as a hot pursuit, is therefore invalid as her arrest took place within her residence. This is all from the district court.
Well, I submit what the evidence is, the evidence actually submitted to the district court, has the officers specifically saying that they announced the arrest on the doorstep, she retreated. Anderson's point was that she never got into the doorway, she was 3 feet away and then retreated. I think it's a clear issue of fact. I think that's what the evidence is. And you look at what the evidence is actually submitted. And when I look at the, like I said, I look at the district court's and his legal analysis of why that is, because he doesn't believe that those are, that it's a Van Eaton case because she's not actually in the doorway and it's only a misdemeanor and she's retreated.
Yeah, you want to save some time for
I will, for because there's a point on the cross appeal.
Okay. Thank you.
Please, the Court. I'm Robert Mann. I represent both of the appellee and appellant, Deborah Anderson. As the appellant, we originally challenged the grant of qualified immunity to the officers, but we have dropped that issue. So that the only reason I'm here as an appellant is on the award of attorney fees. And if I may, I'd like to start with that. Basically,
I don't quite follow what you're saying.
Pardon me?
You're here as appellee because they say there was no constitutional violation, right?
Right. And I'm here as appellant because we say that Judge Ray.
You said something about dropping your challenge to something.
Originally, we appealed two issues. Right. Actually, there's right. four appeals here,
right.
I'm told, this morning. One of them was we appealed the grant of qualified immunity to the officers. We've dropped that. The only thing that we're still the appellant on is the award of attorney fees.
That's all you're appealing.
That's all I'm appealing.
But if they win.
We don't get to that.
You don't get your attorney's fees.
Right. That's right. But I just want to make clear, I want to make clear that I do have a few words to say about the attorney fee issue because I think we should win. We put forward a lot of evidence on what a reasonable rate was. The defendants, through the declaration of Mr. Coates, took issue with the rate that we said should be awarded to us. I think our evidence showed that my time should be compensated at the rate of $450 an hour. Mr. Coates said that that was too high, that my time should be compensated at the rate of $350 an hour. The district court awarded $300 an hour. And the only evidence supporting that, if one can call it evidence, is that the district judge says, based on my experience. And so the question is whether or not a district court with
what do you want him to do then? Just whole life? He's 80 years old.
Well.
Oh, he's older than that. He's probably 86.
86 and going strong, but the question is that enough to justify an award of attorney fees at a rate lower than what the defendants even say?
Well, is the problem that you're pointing to that the judge was rejecting the fees in the record on the basis of experience, or is the problem that he wasn't articulating his experience?
Exactly.
Which one? There are two different arguments. One is that he just can't do it. And the other is that he at least has to explain what experience he's relying on.
Well, I think that he has to do one or the other. In our view, there has to be actual evidence that the experience of the district judge just standing alone is not enough.
I think we've actually, haven't we approved instances in which the judge relies on an experience as long as he tells us what experience he's relying on?
Not that I know of. But
Suppose the judge said, look, I've been sitting in this district for a long time, and I have seen in the past year lots of these affidavits, and I know for X year what the going rate is for certain kinds of cases, and for me to disregard what I know because of these declarations that you've happened to brought in here would really be silly. So I'm going to put those declarations into the overall mix, but overall, from what everything I know, this is the going rate for this kind of case. If he was specific, so you knew he was looking at the right year and the right kind of case as opposed to more general time period or the more general kind of case, what would be wrong with that?
Okay, that's one issue. The other issue is that the district judge declined to award any fees at all for the preparation of the reply papers on the fee motion without any explanation at all, which I don't think is proper. And the third issue is that we prevailed on a California cause of action, 52.1B of the Civil Code, the Unruh Civil Rights Act, and under Ketchum versus Moses, a recent California Supreme Court case, under California law, where there is a contingent risk, the prevailing party is entitled to a multiplier. And I know that
they, you absolutely are entitled to a multiplier, didn't they?
Well, did I say
absolutely?
I said,
well, you said you are entitled, and that sounds like, well, the judge couldn't not give us a multiplier, doesn't it?
Yes. But in the absence of some countervailing explanation, reason, evidence, I believe that under California law, the California Supreme Court is like, you should be entitled to
that. The judgment here was for what, $25,000?
$25,000, exactly.
And what was the attorney fee award? $124,000?
$120,000.
$124,000.
Right. About that.
Well, I mean, you want to make it $120,000?
If it was 120, 124, I don't recall exactly. But the defendant's argument is that there's a proportionality analysis here and that awarding any more would be inappropriate. But the United States Supreme Court in Riverside versus Rivera awarded $245,000, $245,456 on a $33,350 judgment. So I don't think that one can look at a proportionality analysis. One has to look at what...
The question really isn't whether one could, it's whether one did, isn't it?
Pardon?
It's a question whether one could or whether he did. In other words, Judge Ray really said very little about this issue. He said he thinks it's a reasonable fee the way it is, period. Is that right?
Right. If what the court is saying, and I'm having difficulty hearing, frankly...
I'm sorry.
It's not the court's fault. He didn't really explain very much of anything at all. He just said, I don't think it would be appropriate. And I don't think that given the fact that normally one would be entitled to a multiplier under California law, that that's enough. I mean, if he wants to have a reasoned explanation that we can deal with, fine. But there is no reasoned explanation.
When was Riverside versus Riviera decided? Oh,
many, many, many years ago. But it's never been overruled. It's still good law. It was an appeal out of this district. It was Judge Feltzer, actually, was the trial judge in that case.
Yeah. Who was on the panel?
I couldn't begin to remember.
Well, it's not good law under federal law. You're looking at California law, right?
That's correct.
That's really correct.
I mean, as we're looking both at California. That's for the multiplier and federal law for, you know, whether or not there is a proportionality requirement. There isn't under federal law. I mean, I know Congress, you know, considered it some years ago whether or not there should be. And I think under the Prison Litigation Reform Act.
What were the facts of Riverside versus Riviera?
Pardon me?
What were the facts?
I believe it was the Riverside Sheriff's Department raid on a party. And there were a large number of people involved, and people were arrested, people were injured or beaten up, and I believe that the only award was on the state law claim. And that's all I can really remember. But to return to my, or to go back to my role as the appellee here, there is a couple things I'd like to say. I think that...
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
I'm just curious. Now, when you took this case, you took it out of contingent fees?
Absolutely.
All right.
I mean, I have not gotten a nickel from anybody on this case. Okay. I've only been doing it for how many years now?
So your answer is yes.
Correct.
Now, under your contract... Does your client keep the $25,000?
Client keeps every cent of the $25,000. That's our agreement. The contract actually would permit me to take a part of the $25,000, but as between the client and me, no. I mean, most cases, the client gets whatever the jury awards. I mean, I do reserve the right in the contract and if I don't get paid from the court, to take it out of what the client's award would be, but I've never in my career done so. So, you know, I pay all the costs, you know, pay it for all the everything, you know. There's, you know, and there are cases where you never get paid, and under California law, I mean that's contingent risk. And
did you get your costs back?
I haven't seen a cent yet. Eventually, I hope to.
Entitled to it.
Yeah. Yeah. A couple of points that I would like to stress. One is that one of the primary things that the defendants rely upon is a statement in the preliminary hearing testimony on a page that I also submitted that talks about the service of this prior restraining order on Smith and Ms. Anderson's residence. The defendants never pointed to that transcript below. They never called attention to the transcript. Indeed, they objected to any consideration of that transcript, and that's found at excerpt of record page 87. I cited, as is required by the rule, the law in this circuit and in the district court, to specific questions and answers contained in that transcript, and I did not cite to that portion that the defendants now rely on, that they never relied on in the district court. And their position is that because I used a portion of the transcript, that they're entitled, despite the fact that they objected to any use of it, and despite the fact that...
Which use of what? The preliminary hearing transcript?
Pardon me?
They objected to any use of the preliminary hearing transcript?
They objected to any use of the preliminary hearing transcript. That's it. That's an excerpt of record page 87.
What's an excerpt of record page 87? Their objection?
Their objection was that it was...
I see. Okay.
You know, I mean, their objection was had no merit. I mean, I was using it as an admission. Mm-hmm. But I cited to page and line, and I did not cite to the page and line that they're now relying on, for the first time on appeal, never having brought it to the attention of this district judge. I do not think that that conceivably could be proper. Another point that I think is worth keeping in mind, and that is a lot of the evidence that they now rely on was contained in a declaration submitted on June the 27th for a July the 2nd hearing. We originally noticed the motion on May the 21st. We continued it from June the 11th to July the 2nd at the request of the defendants. They did not submit this Titus declaration until June the 27th, which in terms of court days, I think was 2 court days before the hearing of the motion. And we objected to that on every ground, including Rule 56C, which requires that all declarations in support of a summary judgment motion be submitted 10 days before the hearing, which obviously this particular declaration.
And did the judge admit it or did he not admit it?
I objected. He said it's untimely and it wouldn't make any difference anyhow. And so it's untimely. It should not be considered. And without that, they really do not have any leg to stand on. Another point that I think is worth looking at is that the position we took in the district court, one that the district court never even talked about, was that they did not have probable cause to arrest Ms. Anderson in the first place. Because, you know, their declaration saying that they believe that she was under the influence of something was based on nothing more than a police officer saying, I am a trained and recognized drug recognition expert, period. There was nothing about his experience, nothing about his training, nothing about, you know, what it was about Ms. Anderson that caused him to believe that she was under the influence of anything, or why that particular something was, you know, proved that she was under the influence of something. And we objected to that. And in any other context, that type of supposed expert opinion would not get to first base, and it should not have gotten to first base here. So the difficult issue is, what do you do at the door? You know, if you answer a door, does that mean you can get arrested? I don't think you need to. I don't think you really need to reach that question. You certainly don't need to reach it under federal law, because under state law, it's clear. People versus Ramey, decided by the California Supreme Court before Peyton was decided, and upon which Peyton relied, was a situation where the police went to a person's door with probable cause to arrest that person for a felony and arrested him at the door. And the California Supreme Court said, based on both Fourth Amendment and California constitutional law, that that violated the Constitution.
Essentially, you're saying that we could decide, we could avoid the issue of how Benetton applies to this case by deciding under California law.
Absolutely. Now, I agree with Your Honor, Judge Berzon, that and what I agreed to be the facts here were what the defendants said the facts were in their separate statement, which we agreed were the facts. I mean, they set forth a separate statement. It's at page, the critical facts are at page 10 of our excerpt, the appellee's excerpt, where they say they went to the door, they voiced their suspicion that she might be under the influence, she backed away from the door, and they went in and arrested her. That violates Peyton, that violates Van Eaton, that violates Oaxaca, that violates, there is no justification for that. Under Lalonde, they don't get qualified immunity for that, even according to Judge Trott in his dissenting opinion in Lalonde. So I think they're stuck.
Even according to what?
There was a dissenting opinion in Lalonde,
oh,
the case,
yes,
by Judge Trott, and I thought, well, he was dissenting from the court's determination that the officers were not entitled to qualified immunity on the entry, but that's not true. He agreed that the officers were not entitled to qualified immunity on the entry. He dissented to on some other basis, but he agreed that they were not entitled to qualified immunity on the entry. And in Lalonde, Lalonde was standing close enough to the front door so that the officer who was outside could reach in and grab him by his T-shirt and try to pull him out. And Miss Anderson, according to them, was 3 to 5 feet back inside.
If she'd been standing at the front door, let's say, close to the threshold, it becomes very problematic. If they said right then, you're under arrest.
I think that as long as she's inside, that the proper rule is what the court said in United States versus Johnson, which is that you can't, let me get that language. I thought I had it right here, but apparently I don't. Anyhow, basically what the court said, this court said, was that you can't, that the critical fact is where the person arrested is at the time of the arrest, not where the officer is. That if you let the determining factor be where the officer is, then there'll be the attempt to determine or move right here. This is a.
But in Veniaton, we.
Pardon me?
In Veniaton, we
right.
said, if you're standing at the front door, we're not going to putz around with whether your foot's inside the threshold or outside the threshold. The officer can arrest you then. If you've opened the door voluntarily, you can be arrested then. In Albrechtson, we said essentially the same thing.
Well, Albrechtson, I think Your Honor said something a little different. I think that Albrechtson is really a different case because in Albrechtson, as the author of that opinion pointed out, they had a warrant. So it didn't make any difference. They could have gone in to arrest her. They had a warrant. So whether or not she was at the front door or inside made no difference.
They said you could arrest the person at the front door, and you should.
You should.
And we said that the person standing at the front door, you can arrest them there.
But if you look at Van Eaton, especially in light of the dissenting opinion, it looks to me like the court was paying a great deal of attention to the fact that the person inside had opened the door knowing that the police were outside. I mean, there's one portion of the opinion where the court italicizes under these circumstances. And every time that the court talks about being permitted to arrest the person who comes through the door, the court says, under these circumstances, and repeats the fact that the guy inside the motel room opened the window, looked outside, saw it was the police, and then came to the door. so that under those circumstances, it could be said that the suspect was acquiescing in the encounter. You know, the court says when Van Eaton saw them through the window, he voluntarily opened the door and exposed both himself and the immediate area to them. So that I think that Van Eaton turns on the fact that Van Eaton knew the police were outside when he opened the door to them. And is...
Do you want to address the other issue in the case, the F2 arrest according to the warrant?
I'm afraid I just didn't understand the word.
I'm sorry. Do you want to address the other explanation for the arrest, that is, the assertion that Smith was present in the house?
It was so clear that Mr. Smith did not reside in Ms. Anderson's home, that it really is, should not be an issue. Before the police got involved, a couple of months before this incident happened, he had resided with his girlfriend, whom he got arrested for battering, and he had resided for her for a long period of time. He gets arrested for battering his girlfriend. He's no longer residing with her at that time. Then he's residing in the jail for several months. And all of these telephone calls that are from Smith to Ms. Sunderson are from the jail to Ms. Sunderson's answering machine. That's all that there was.
So there was no contact between him and Ms. Sunderman after he was released from jail and after he was served on October 9th at Ms. Anderson's home?
There is not a scintilla of evidence that there was any contact between Smith and Sunderson after he was released from jail or while he was in jail or at any time after he was arrested other than Smith's telephone calls from jail to Ms. Sunderson's answering machine. And he also had flowers sent to her. But I don't have any information that the flowers bore any information. And so what happened was that Ms. Anderson agreed to put up Mr. Smith for a few days because he didn't have any place to go after they released him for jail. And so he was there for a few days, and he was gone. She loaned him a car for a few days. He returned the car, and he was gone. And that's what the evidence showed. And that isn't, quote, residence. So unless there's something else.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Just a quick note on what the district court found on the summary judgment. I think if you look at the district court's order granting summary judgment at ER 103 and also its subsequent order denying the motion for new trial in which the court again explicated its reasons for granting summary judgment, and that's at ER 154-155, I think the court makes it very clear that the reason they're finding it's not a Van Eaton case is because the judge viewed it exactly as the close case that Judge Fernandez indicated, which is the court read the testimony as the officer announcing you're under arrest when she had taken a couple of steps back from the doorway. And then they entered, you're right, to complete the arrest after she had retreated another 15 to 20 feet. But the district court found that the only reason why I didn't believe it was Van Eaton because she was at the doorway, observed officer suspicion, and then retreats a couple of steps, still in the officer's view. And the officer saying,
what about Lalonde then? I mean, in other words, the district judge, as you say, understood that she was inside her apartment, whether a few steps or many steps, when she was placed under arrest. So isn't Lalonde therefore the controlling precedent?
No, because in Lalonde, the officers don't announce that you're under arrest or detained while they're outside or while he's near the doorstep. They go in after.
She was announced under, and you didn't say that it was announced that she was under arrest when she was outside.
When she was at the doorstep. I think our declarations say that.
Yes, but the district court didn't say that, and you didn't say that when you were just explaining what the district court said. You've been wandering around from one set of facts to another in a way that's very confusing and disturbing.
Well, I'm sorry. Let me make the point clear is that the declarations submitted by the officers, I think, do clearly set the fact that they say she's at the doorway.
So they contradict what they said at the preliminary hearing, and they contradict the material facts as stated in the statement of undisputed facts.
Okay. I'm dealing now just with the declaration, not the preliminary hearing. I understand the court's point on that. I'm saying that's not something that the district court made a ruling on and decided to disregard.
Well, they did, because he it seems to me, implicitly rejected the declarations either for timing reasons or other reasons because he found that they didn't arrest her until she got into the apartment.
But what he defines as in the residence is three steps from the doorway. And I think the question is, if you want to put it, it's kind of what Judge Fernandez, is it a closer case if you're just a few steps, if you're seen at the doorway, the officers see you commit the misdemeanor, you retreat 2 to 3 steps, and they effect the arrest. They say you're under arrest. I think that's what we're talking about here. I mean, I think that is the close case, and I think that's exactly what the district court thought was a close case. He thought under Van Eaton that he wouldn't extend Van Eaton that far. And I think, we submit that under Santana and in the language of Van Eaton, the fact that you're 3 feet from the doorway, you're still visible from a public place. And you committed the crime in the officer's presence in the doorway, and then you retreat. That's why. And I think that it's just a straight-up legal question for the district court judge, is that he wasn't willing to extend Van Eaton to the 3 steps down from the doorway.
Was there evidence that after he got out of prison that he called his, former girlfriend that he'd beaten up?
He left he clearly left 18 messages.
After October 9th.
Not after October 9th. The period runs.
Is there any evidence that he left any messages after October 9th?
I'm not sure.
Well, that's what I'm asking.
No, I'm sure. I think the testimony is from like September 18th through early October. I'd have to look if there are any on October 9th, because he wasn't in custody after October 9th.
Right. So he only left messages while he was in jail. Is that right?
He might have left some after, but I don't know that they're after October 9th. That is correct.
You told us something else about that before, too. I mean, you keep altering your representations about what's in the record.
I'm sorry if I'm not clear, but I think the point is that from October 9th, the argument that I've made is that having relied on Sunderman's accurate statements on October 9th to serve him at the residence, that they had reason to believe he continued to be a resident.
Well,
not that they, not that they were.
Check, but I believe that you told me quite specifically that there were phone calls after.
I'm sorry. If that's the impression, no.
I'm
sorry.
That's the way I heard it.
I'm sorry. I apologize, because the point for me is that the contact on October 9th is good. It's the reliable informant who gives you information. It turns out to be correct. You rely on it. You have no reason to believe he's no longer currently residing there. That's the point. I'm sorry if unintentionally misled the court.
The defendant's position on attorney's fees was that a reasonable fee in these circumstances was $350 an hour, huh?
For some attorneys, but not for all of them.
For this gentleman.
Well, it was a sliding scale, but the testimony was twofold. The testimony was these are reasonable hourly rates, and the total number of hours is too high. And what the district court judge did was say, it's the old thing. You pay for efficiency. He gave them almost all of their hours, but he gave them at a lower rate. And so at the end of the day, what you look at is you look at the reasonableness of the fee award. And the evidence was that the fee span from the defense, by the way, was from $150 to $350. Now, this expert specifically testified that, in his opinion, these guys might make $350. But that's in light of reducing the hours, too. That's the efficiency part of it. And I think what they're trying to do is divorce that out.
How many hours did you spend on this?
On the trial litigation, I did not try the case. The bulk of the hours is or trial hours. And I think there's a testimony from the trial attorney from the city of Long Beach attesting to that. And as to the multiplier, I think the court's dead right under Ketchum.
We let you go over your time, so.
That's fine. Thank you, Your Honor.
The matter will stand submitted. And we'll go to the next matter, which is Rosetalis versus Morgan Stanley. Mm-hmm. right, Mr. Olmos, you may proceed.
Good morning. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Robert Tomas Olmos for the plaintiff and appellant in this matter. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Because there are so many issues involved in this case, what I'd like to do is focus on the pretext issue, which applies to all the claims of discrimination, because I think that really is at the heart of this case. Here we have an individual, an employee, who's been employed since 1995 as a financial broker, successfully. And she's been successful in part because she's been allowed to prospect away from the office using an ACE remote system, which was approved by management. And as a result, subsequent to her prospecting away from the office with management's endorsement and encouragement, she is then subsequently promoted. Because of her successful performance, she is promoted to the title of Associate Vice President. Again,
which is based only on how much business she did, right?
Pardon?
Which is based solely on how much business she does now.
Correct. On her actual production, on her ability to sell, and that's the focus of her goal. And during the course of her performance, there is no issue about attendance whatsoever. The issue of attendance doesn't surface until 1998, after Ms. Rizzitello has raised issues of discrimination, has complained about discrimination with regard to gender in terms of transferring of accounts, with regard to sexual harassment in the workplace. These are complaints are made, nothing ever happens. But now in June of 1998, we have a new branch manager that comes into the picture. In 3 months later, Ms. Rizzitello continues to observe discrimination with regard to transferring accounts and brings a complaint of discrimination to Mr. Wilson, the new branch manager. This is 3 months later. And from that point forward,
when was that exactly?
September of 98 was when she first complained to Mr. Wilson, the new branch manager, who had started in June of 1998, 3 months prior. She follows that up in January of 1998 with another complaint with regard to discrimination in a meeting with Mr. Wilson. She follows that up with a written memo complaining of discrimination to Mr. Wilson and threatening to go to Human Resources and to Equal Employment Opportunity Commission to level the field. Shortly after that meeting in January, shortly after that written memo of complaint, Mr. Wilson summons Ms. Rizzitello into her office and demands that she be physically in the office 5 days a week, 9 to 5. And it's at this stage that Ms. Rizzitello is now forced to disclose that she has a disability, a breathing problem. And as a result of that, Mr. Wilson backs off, at least temporarily, and agrees, okay, that she can do this, but gives her a form to fill out. Ms. Rizzitello checks out the form, calls corporate office about this form, and she is told, no, that form is if you are disabled and unable to work. And Ms. Rizzitello returns the form to Mr. Wilson, and no further word is mentioned with regard to any particular forms for her to fill out. Now, this is all in January of 1998. And Ms. Rizzitello is continuing to perform successfully, despite the fact that her breathing condition has been aggravated, and she is now under medical care. March, for example, she receives an award. March of 98, she receives an award. March of 99, she receives a recognition award. In April, the following month, she receives another award for the Mid-Tier Rising Star Award. That was April 5, 1999. 3 days later, Mr. Wilson calls her in. And in a short 5-minute meeting, angrily demands that Ms. Rizzitello is going to be required to report to the office 5 days a week, 9 to 5. Now, it's
very concerning. There's a document in the record that I think is at 198, 199, but I'm not sure, that is a report of a discussion on 3399 between Wilson and Rizzitello, I gather, which suggests that there was an earlier discussion of the of her need to go into the office more and so on. When was the first discussion of her having to come into the office?
In January 1999.
Right.
Yeah. Now, and the reason that was articulated for the need for her to come to the office was the need to supervise her. And because of a concern about that her accounts were being over-centralized and they weren't diversified enough. Now, it's very interesting that on these two issues, there is absolutely no evidence that's been produced by the defendants of any attendance policy whatsoever. There's no evidence produced with regard to any policy with regard to diversification of accounts presented. All we have is prior to that January of 1999, this has not been an issue. It has not been a problem. Quite to the contrary, Ms. Rizzitello has been acknowledged and awarded commendations and titles and promotions because of her performance. Now, without any kind of written policy, Mr. Wilson, on his own, has now injected a subjective standard of his own interpretation that she is required to now be physically in the office. At the same time, Mr. Wilson has admitted in his testimony that with regard to her physical absence from the branch office, that he has never had any problem being able to locate her, that there has never, that she has never missed any major meeting, that no client had ever complained about her, and could not identify any business opportunities that had been missed because she was not present. With regard to the over-concentration of accounts, there's absolutely no evidence that there was any problem raised with regard to her managing of the accounts that she had, whether they were good trades or bad trades. If anything, the record indicates that her clients were very happy with her to the degree that they remained with her even after she was terminated. There was absolutely no evidence that the accounts that she managed, how she handled them, that there was ever any issue with regard to any improprieties. There was never.
Now, presumably, despite all that, a company could have a policy that said we simply want people in the office, we want you in the office 50% of the time, or we want reasonable attendance, and if it's not reasonable, we may take action, but your position is that they had none of those policies.
Correct. This policy was directed specifically at Ms. Rizzitello.
Is there any evidence in the record about how much the other agents were actually there?
There is time logs that were submitted for a specific period of time, Your Honor, which does show that advisors were in the office substantially more time than Ms. Rizzitello. There is no issue about that. The issue is the fact that in order to sell, there is not a requirement, a necessity for one to be physically in the office.
What do you mean by substantially more time? It seems to me that they were there most of the time and she was away most of the time.
Correct. And she had been away frequently even prior.
That's not the question. Why can't an employer say, I would like to have you come into the office? Guess what? We're a business. We want you here.
Well, the problem is if that was for the purpose of being implemented in a uniform, consistent manner and had nothing to do with the fact that her.
I thought you just told me that uniformly and consistently.
Well, the question is the motivation.
I look at the record. Everybody else is there. But she isn't. And she doesn't think she should have to come into work. I thought that's what you said.
Well, not quite, Your Honor. What I'm saying is, here we're looking at motivation. Is the purpose to implement, truly implement, this in a uniform manner, in a neutral manner, or is it, in fact, to punish her because she is, in fact, being successful? She's being acknowledged by headquarters for being successful and being rewarded and encouraged to this. They're the ones who allowed her, enabled her to successfully prospect away from the office by giving her the ACE remote program.
That's not my question. Are you saying that the manager cannot tell her to come in?
If...
Are you telling me the manager...
The question is the motivation, Your Honor.
Are you telling me the manager cannot tell her that he wants her in the office more?
Yes, he can tell her to do that. But
and she can say, nuts, I'm not going to do it, right?
And she can say, well, she can say that, or she can also say, I have a condition...
We know that's not the case. We know that her doctor even says she can take her tank into the office. Nobody's ever told her she can't. Nobody tells me I can wear my glasses into the office, but nobody's ever told me I can't. And I assume I can. Nobody's ever told her she can't. All she says is she feels uncomfortable doing it. She doesn't want to.
Management.
My question to you is, if management says she's got a new manager and he says, I want you in the office. Now, from your position, I take it, she can say, nope, I don't think I'll come in.
If she has a legitimate reason, and here she did. Here, management did not.
Yes.
Her breathing difficulty. Management refused
her
to engage.
Her doctor even says that her breathing difficulty does not prevent her from going to the office, period. She can take her tank in. That's all she needs to do.
Your Honor, that was not an absolute. Her doctor said unless her condition was aggravated, in which case she would be confined to bed rest.
All right. Is there any evidence that it was?
Yes.
What's that evidence?
Yeah, her doctor testified with regard to the fact that she'd actually been to urgent care.
Yes, but the point is, she's saying, I don't have to come in know-how anytime, and she doesn't. And her doctor never said that she didn't have to be in the office because of her illness. He said, at times of exacerbation, she can't go in. You've got to cut her some slack. Yes, but that doesn't answer what she was doing, does it?
Not entirely, Your Honor. Not entirely, because the breathing tank enables her to move around more than otherwise. But it's not just a matter of the breathing tank. She has a breathing tank that she can haul around. It also requires that she have an ability to rest, a bed to sleep, because she becomes easily fatigued. And that's another part.
Sleep meant, not rest meant, sit down for a while. And I don't know if she was 85 years old, maybe she'd have to sleep.
Yeah, and because of management refusal to engage in the interactive process, these accommodation issues were never addressed.
What interactive process? Nobody ever told her she couldn't just bring the stuff in and sit down.
That wasn't explored.
Where's the interaction?
Ms. Rizzitello.
Say to them, listen, I have a breathing problem. I mean, I say, I can't see. I just put on my glasses and I can walk in. I don't need interaction with management to tell me to put on my glasses, do I?
Well, not in that particular example, Your Honor.
Well, it's the same thing. She says, I can't breathe without, I say, I can't see without my glasses.
Ms. Rizzitello said, I need access to a breathing tank. I need rest, because I become easily fatigued. Management never said, well, can you bring the breathing tank? Is it possible for you to bring your breathing tank into the office? They never entertained that issue.
Okay. I understand.
This is on your discrimination claim based on disability.
Yes. And the duty on the employer is an affirmative duty.
What about your claims based on hostile working environment and gender?
Your Honor, what I wanted to get to with regard to those issues as well in terms of encompassing is a focus on pretext to show that the issue here was not really the issue that defendants have raised in terms of attendance, but because she raised the issues of gender discrimination, of hostile work environment, of disability. And one of the things that I would like to, at this point, bring to the Court's attention is this Court's just recent ruling of last Thursday.
I thought one of your arguments was that there was this gender discrimination, and which he felt, and she'd made that known and complained about it. And this new manager received those complaints, that it was because of that that he was requiring her to come in, you know, the 3 days or the 5 days. He was punishing her because she complained about gender discrimination.
Correct, Your Honor. Yes, correct. That here she had also requested the opportunity to be considered for management, and despite the fact that she had higher sales production, the fact that she had better titles, this same manager refused to consider her for
promotion. How could she manage anybody if she's not in the office?
Pardon?
How could she manage somebody if she's not in the office?
Well, again, Your Honor, even a manager is away from the office weeks at a time. It doesn't literally require someone to be physically in an office every single day. And again, once you're given the responsibility, then you work out the accommodation to fulfill your responsibilities. Just like Ms. Rosatello worked out what she needed to do to sell her product. But she was never given the opportunity to say, you know, even despite the fact that she was being successful. Here she earned her title, her associate vice president title. The other two examples that I cited, one was given the title because he was promoted into the MTA program for which she had requested. And even though she had greater production than this individual, had the title, she refused to consider. Another individual earned the title of AVP only after Mr. Wilson transferred his accounts to this individual, automatically increasing the production for that individual. So these are two individuals, two comparables, who were promoted because of preferential treatment, while at the same time that she was denied that promotional opportunity despite her superior qualifications. And again, I just wanted to reiterate that her claim for disability, the claim for the interactive process, is an affirmative duty on management. It is not the affirmative duty of the employee raising it. She requested the accommodation. She fulfilled her responsibility to trigger this duty on management. Management chose not to engage in the interactive process. When she was demanded to be in the office 5 days a week, 9 to 5, this was a hostile meeting. Mr. Wilson admitted.
She was first demanded to be in 3 days a week, and she didn't come.
Yeah, she was unable to come. Keep in mind, Your Honor, this was a period in which her condition.
Where is the evidence of that in the record? That would be really helpful to me.
The medical records, Your Honor, of Dr. Sandu, showing that during this period, she had lost 50% of her breathing capacity, her heart condition had been aggravated, she had been treated for under emergency care.
During the pandemic, so that she couldn't come to the office at all during that period?
No, she did come to the office, Your Honor. The record, you know, let me be clear. It's not that she didn't come at all. She did not come. She was not able to meet the 3 days per week that she was required of her. And because she was unable to meet the three-day requirement, despite her effort, then he punished her by then increasing it to 5 days a week.
And you can tell me where in the record that is?
Pardon?
Can you tell me where that material is in the record?
Which specific?
The medical records you were just...
Yes. It's... I don't have that before me, Your Honor. But
all right, well, if you get up again, that would be helpful.
Okay. If there are no other questions, I'll reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Okay.
Please report. Now, in this case, Ms. Rosatello's manager, we know, instructed her to come into the office initially three times, and then when she didn't do that, every day. And the very basis of both disability claims and the disability claim and the gender discrimination claim is the repeated statement that the imposition, this condition, imposed on her by the employer was impossible, an impossible requirement given her disability. Now, I think as the Court has already observed, there is absolutely no evidence to support this very threshold point.
And what about the representation that was just made that during the particular period that she was supposed to come in 3 days a week, there are medical records to show that she was, in fact, unable to do so?
I am unaware of any evidence in the record that reflects or supports that statement. And that issue was raised in front of the district court. And I reviewed the record over the weekend, and I am unaware of any evidence which supports that. Dr. Sandu's deposition was taken in this case, as the Court is aware, and there was no testimony elicited from Dr. Sandu that the plaintiff could not come into the office during the period of time in question because of her exacerbated condition. And furthermore, there was no testimony from the plaintiff that she couldn't come into the office during the period in time because of her exacerbated condition. The evidence in the record is that plaintiff could come into the office during the relevant period of time. All she needed to do was bring her breathing tank in with her. However, she testified she was embarrassed to do so. So she chose not to do so.
That's understandable, isn't it? She was embarrassed to do so.
I don't know that it's understandable or not, Your Honor. However, the ADA does not protect against someone from being embarrassed.
The question is, what about the interactive process claim? They knew that she was claiming a disability. They told her she had to come in a certain number of days a week. She said she couldn't do it. Did they, at that point, have some obligation to probe further?
No. The burden is on the plaintiff to identify a reasonable accommodation and to present it to the employer. It is the plaintiff and the plaintiff's health care provider who, I believe, citing the Taylor case from the Fifth Circuit, who is uniquely able to identify what the accommodation would be. In this case, there was no such accommodation identified. The only accommodation that has been...
I thought that our law, though, under Barnett, was that there is an obligation to engage in the interactive process as long as there is a reasonable accommodation that could be reached, which to some degree begs the question of who has to initiate it. And I also thought that there were at least some circumstances in which there is an obligation on the employer to initiate it.
Well, as I read Burnett, it states that there is an obligation so long as the reasonable accommodation is possible or can be reached, as you put it, Your Honor. However, in Burnett, there was medical evidence that the accommodation requested was necessary. Here, there is no medical evidence, nor is there any evidence from the plaintiff that the accommodation requested.
In other words, she did request an accommodation. The question is whether at that point do we say, well, the employer has nothing further to do because the accommodation she requested is unreasonable. That isn't a very good way of triggering an interactive process. Or do we say at that point the employer has some obligation to come back with her to her and say, well, that's not going to work, but let's try and work out something else?
Well, I would say that what was the requirement under these facts, and I think the law in this circuit is that this issue has to be analyzed based on the facts of each case, is that based on these facts, where you have a plaintiff or an employee and a health care provider who is uniquely knowledgeable about what the accommodation would be, that it's up to the plaintiff to come up with a reasonable accommodation initially.
I don't think that's wrong. I really don't think it's wrong. I mean, I will check, but I don't think so. Let me ask you something. I keep staring at this little document that I asked about before. It's dated 3-3-99. And it seems to me that it's helpful to you because it says that Wilson says that he's going to talk to her. He's going to ask for medical certification to review so we can accommodate and still get her into the office to satisfy the supervisory needs. Did he ever do that?
No, I didn't hear the end of your question.
There's a handwritten little
I'm familiar with that document.
That seems to be a recounting of a conversation on 3-3-99. And it says that, I'm assuming it's in Wilson's handwriting, but I don't know. Anyway, it says that his plan is to ask for medical certification to review so we can accommodate her and still get her into the office to satisfy supervisory needs. Did that ever happen?
It did happen. He gave her a medical form.
That was in January, right?
No, actually, that was in April. There was some conflict in the evidence based on Ms. Rezzatella's testimony. I think at one point she said it was in January, and then later she said it was in April.
The problem is he gave her the wrong form, or he...
Well, her testimony was that he gave her a form. She called someone in HR in New York, and that person told her that would mean she had to go out on disability, so she refused to sign the form.
I mean, this does seem on this issue to be a sort of a breakdown in communication, in that if this had been followed through on, which seemed to be a well-intentioned thing originally, they may have been able to get her into the office with gotten over her embarrassment, gotten into the office with her oxygen, and gotten her and not had to fire her. And you sort of wonder how this breakdown occurred and why.
Well, the breakdown only occurred because she refused to come into the office with her breathing tank. What we're losing sight of here is, based on this record...
Nobody ever suggested that she do it either.
Well, there's no evidence that she even identified that she has a breathing tank. I mean, the question is, why doesn't she just do it? I mean, there's at this point in the record, when we're here on summary judgment, her prima facie obligation is to come forward and identify an objectively reasonable accommodation.
Now, let me ask you one other thing that's been troubling me in the pretext question. I understand the concerns about the concentration of her business, and both in terms of its continuity and also compliance issues, although those are never spelled out with any particularity. But what exactly does her coming into the office or not coming into the office have to do with it? I can think of lots of other good reasons why people should have to be in the office, but the office, the reason that was given mostly was the need to supervise her for that. As to that question, and how is her being there or not being there going to make a difference on that question?
Well, you have a first of all, Mr. Wilson is the branch manager. He's the one in the trenches, and it's his obligation to protect the clients and Morgan Stanley. And what he sees is a potential problem, and the problem is twofold. You have all of her accounts concentrated, 75-80% of them, into three elderly clients. So you've got a problem there with the over-concentration of the accounts. Those clients leave, and you have an issue with...
I understand the problem. I want to know how this is...
If you need to supervise someone, the way to do it is to get them in the office face-to-face and supervise them. I mean, that's how it's done. If I have an associate who's billing 5,000 hours a year, where we think, gee, that's great, and that associate's doing it at home, I say, well, there's a problem here, and we want that person in the office so we can talk to him and her, so we can counsel the associate and supervise the associate. Yeah,
tell
our associates
and tell them to work 6,000.
But they all can access the network from home, but do we permit them to work at home? No, because we need to be there to talk to them, to nurture them, and to show them how to be better lawyers. That's how it works. You just don't allow someone
now,
to just...
Also, over this time period, I gather there's at least conflict in the evidence about whether he actually mentioned this concern to her. In other words, I believe she says he never even mentioned this to her, and he says that he did. I mean, what is the evidence about what he tried to do to correct these problems, other than get her in the office?
The evidence, as I understand the record, is he wanted her in the office. And let's be practical about this. His
driving concern was these problems, and the problems were acute. Did he tell her that was his problem?
Well,
did he try to advise her to quite aside from coming to the office to change her practices?
Yeah, he wanted to be there to talk to her and tell her.
You're answering my question.
I'm sorry?
You're not answering the question.
I'm sorry. I can't hear you. I didn't understand the question.
The question is, aside from getting her into the office, which I can think of lots of good reasons for, what did he try to do over this time period while he was her supervisor to address these particular concerns?
I'm unaware of anything other than to first get her in the office.
Did he tell her this is why he wanted her in the office?
He told, yes, and that's uncontradicted.
Well, he says he did. She says he didn't, right? So there's a conflict in the evidence on that.
No, I don't believe so. I believe that in the record is that he told her he wanted her in the office to supervise her.
Because,
her response
because
was,
of the overconcentration of her business? Because of compliance concerns? Because of any of that? I mean, it's a little odd because it seems to me if he was really concerned about that, he could have started to take action on several fronts. One of which was to get her in the office, but the other was to try to do something about it.
Well, the evidence is, based on Ms. Rizzatello's testimonies, he said supervisor. Anything else that Mr. Wilson's declaration, I believe, set forth why he wanted to, and he talked about the concentration of the
company. Right,
I can't say if there's a dispute in the record on that or not right
but
now.
But he kept his reasons secret and did not, in the meanwhile, try and get her to do anything about these problems. That certainly gives a little bit of concern about whether this really is reason. He wasn't trying to do anything about those reasons.
Well, yeah, he wanted to get her in the office.
I know, but other than getting her in the office, he let it ride for 6 months.
He let her...
Didn't he call her up and say, you know, I'm worried about you've got two major accounts, and these have resulted in, $750,000 worth of fees. And, you know, we're concerned about, well, maybe there's some churning going on here. And, you know, that's not a good thing to do. And did he ever tell her that?
Well, his testimony is that he did. He didn't mention turning, I don't think, but I think he said that he wanted her to diversify her book of business, and that was the primary focus. However, I think we're losing sight of something, is that he's the boss. He does get to tell her to come into the office. It is not the least bit unreasonable for an employer to see the problem situation develop.
Unless he's telling her to come into the office because she's been complaining about sex discrimination. So that's what we're trying to find out.
There's absolutely no evidence of that, and there certainly is. It's legitimate for a manager to want to supervise an employee who is identified as having a problem. I don't think it can be denied that just based on common knowledge, the facts presented do create a problem.
That's been identified as having a problem. That's why we're probing the issue.
Right.
Trying to find out is in what respect was she identified as having a problem, other than an after-the-fact explanation. So we're trying to find out if there's some way to, on a summary judgment basis,
right,
to determine that this was not an after-the-fact explanation.
And I'm faced with a summary judgment record where I can't, if Mr. Wilson testified, he told her specific reasons, and she says all he did was say he wanted to supervise me.
Well, then we have
it's the latter
of the evidence, and maybe we have to go to trial.
Well, I don't think you have to go to trial if the issue is, does the employer have the right to ask someone under these facts to come into the office, and does he have to give a reason why? I don't think he does. I don't think Mr. Wilson has to explain.
What if his reason was that she complained about sexual comments and conduct in the office and that she was uncomfortable working there? And she let him know that. And then shortly thereafter, he decided that she should come in every day into the office.
Well, I guess you're assuming, therefore, that the legitimate reason that he's offered, that he's identified this as a problem situation, and that he wants to address it before the complaints come in. Now,
can't you draw the inference that one of the reasons nobody ever called her in before, and certainly the company knew she was doing all this business with these two elderly people, and then she complains about some of the language and some of the conduct and how she feels about it, and then it's after that that they start bringing her in, that he wants her to.
Well, you can only draw that inference under the law, Your Honor, if you reject the legitimate reason for asking her to come in. And I don't see how that can be rejected. I mean, in 1998 and 1999, customers didn't complain. Everyone was happy. But it's Wilson's job to make sure they don't complain if the company doesn't get sued.
But
let's face it.
That's exactly why I was trying to probe the question of what evidence there is that the reason that he gave was the reason. I mean, that's what I'm trying to find out. In other words, is there anything what is in the record to demonstrate before this lawsuit began that the reason why he wanted her in the office, I know when he said to supervisor, but was specifically these concerns about the diversity of her business, compliance, and so on. That's what I need to know.
Yeah,
it would really be helpful, and I'm not, I really have not made up my mind about this. I need to know this.
It is in the record that he identified, or that he identified internally, the diversity issue and the over-concentration issue, and that she admitted that he told her that she needed to get a handle on her being office in the office regularly. But it's clear from Wilson's declaration that he went through, he computed the percentage of her business that was concentrated in these accounts, and he needed to address it. And I don't see how that can be denied as legitimate management prerogative. If they get sued, and it turns out that she's not in the office. I absolutely agree with you about that,
if that was the reason.
Excuse me?
I absolutely agree that you're right, if that were, in fact, if that's the reason. So that's what we're trying to find out, is what evidence is there that that was the reason.
The evidence is in Tal Wilson's declaration. He identifies specifically the process he went through and how he reached the conclusion.
You said something about that process beginning before she complained.
His process began before she complained. He noticed that when he came in June that she was regularly absent, and he first tried to deal with it by just asking her, you know, what's up, can't you be in more often? And then when she didn't respond, he ultimately insisted that she come in on a daily basis, and then they reached the three-day compromise, which she didn't fulfill, by the way. But she didn't come in.
He got there in June, and he begins reviewing it. And he says to himself, there's a problem here. Yes?
That's correct.
There's any paper trail for that.
It's in Wilson's declaration.
The way we know that he thought about it before she complained is he says so. Is that right?
That's correct.
That's the only way we know.
That's, yes, based on the evidence in the record that she complained.
He didn't notify the company before that, before she complained, and say to the company, you know, I think there's a problem here. He didn't do any of that.
No, I think the record on summary judgment is that he called her in to ask her to come in more often before he heard about the alleged disability, but after she claims she complained.
After she complained.
Yes, that would be
discrimination.
That's correct.
How about what she was complaining about the working environment? You know, the comments and the conduct, inappropriate.
Well, it's our position that that claim is time barred. First, they try to resurrect it through one statement in May of 1999, which is not from the same people that she complained about earlier and not directed to her. It's in a entirely different practice. It's not related. The complaints she made before that are barred by the statute of limitations were all directed at her. They stopped in November of 1998. Now, in May of 1999, nothing happens in the interim. All those claims, all those comments would be time barred. In May of 1999, she states that a coworker made a comment that was not even directed at her. And I would say, under Morgan, that has to be barred. Secondly, that statement was not identified.
Because it wasn't directed at her personally.
Yes, it's not related to her primary claim, which was these statements were directed to her, and it's 6 months removed from the last conduct that she complained about. Plus,
did this new man who came on the job, did he know about her complaints? Based on what was being said in the office and the inappropriate comments and conduct.
No,
he knew nothing about.
In fact, her testimony is they stopped after he came on board. So management, at least inferentially, had taken action to terminate the practice. 6 months, assuming it occurred, 6 months goes by, and then somebody makes a comment that's not even related to her that can't invoke the continuing violation doctrine. Additionally, that comment that she relies on wasn't identified in response to discovery when we asked her to identify the comments on which she based her claim. That's the purpose of discovery, as you know, so we can assess on which she's basing her claim, to move for summary judgment, and then she is attempting to rely on it now. So I think either way that claim has to fail.
And do you happen to know whether there's apparently in December 1998 is when he first talked to her by coming to the office, is that right? December 2nd, 1998?
I thought it was January.
Well, I see something about it in your entry. This is in a position. Your entry was December 2nd, 1998. The second says, I said if she did not work within the standard office environment, I could not supervise her activity and could therefore no longer be able to keep her. I don't have the rest of it here, but if that was the discussion, did he say also at that time that he told her about his diversity concern?
I don't know, Your Honor.
I got it. Did he ever tell her that he's concerned in any, did he ever address the problem, which she now says is a reason he had to come to the office? Did he ever say to her, talk to her specifically about the need to diversify her book of business and why and so on? What is the evidence that he did that?
It's in his declaration, I believe.
That's not his declaration. I just looked through his declaration. He never says he told her that. He says he needed her in the office to supervise her, but he never says, and he goes through his own internal process, but he never says he told it to her.
All right, well, then that's the only evidence in the record concerning his statement to her as to why he needed her there.
Okay, well, he never says that he told it to her. It's a very strange way to proceed if that's your main concern, is never to say what it is.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
It's a strange way to proceed if you're trying to fix something, to get into get lock horns on the issue of her coming to the office and never address the underlying problem.
Well, I believe an employer has the right to tell an employee to come into the office. I think it would be strange as an employee not coming in the office.
We're not arguing about that. I don't think that's
I mean, the point on summary judgment, we weren't looking to raise tribal issues of fact. We understood that what Ms. Resitella's testimony was on that issue, that we didn't see the point of it. Now, I've exceeded my time. If there's anything further from the court. Thank you.
Okay. To follow up on that, whether Ms. Rizzitella was told about any clarification why she was needed in the office, that's the very same question that Ms. Rizzitella asked to Mr. Wilson. Why? Explain to me, what is it? What is the problem? And he was unable to articulate anything besides the fact, I need to supervise you. She asked, are there any complaints from clients? No. Have I missed any mandatory meetings? No. She asked a series of questions, and Mr. Wilson was unable to provide any specification, no details, other than I need to have this to supervise you.
Let me ask you this. One of your arguments here is that Morgan Stanley was not entitled to summary judgment on your client's discrimination claims that were based on hostile working environment, right?
Correct.
Okay. Now, just tell me what there is in the record to support your position on that.
Okay. With respect to the ongoing, clearly there was a break in terms of some of the egregious sexual harassment comments and jokes that were made. There was a break in time where there was no continuation other than the one that occurred in May. But part of our claim here in terms of the hostile work environment is that it's not limited to acts of a sexual nature. Acts of a sexual nature are not required to be part of the hostile work environment. Part of the hostile work environment that we've identified is the manner in which she was treated throughout this period, including by Mr. Wilson, in terms of demeaning her, yelling at her, requiring her to – harassing her by requiring her to report to the office before going to an early morning meeting. In other words, he was saying, if you – she asked, in terms of, if I have an early meeting
– But on this hostile working environment issue, sex discrimination doesn't come into it?
Yes. Well, not sex in that – in terms of the your more traditional sexual harassment in terms of physical grabbing or just of sexual nature.
We're talking about comments and – that were
comments or treatment that because of her gender, that all goes towards harassment. If the harassment that she's been endured in terms of being having her working environment made more difficult by having to check into the office before going to an early morning appointment, having to report back to the office even after finishing a late evening appointment rather than going home directly.
That's all true of everybody else in the office.
Well, she was the only evidence is that nobody else was being required to do that.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's like a classic problem with people who push the envelope in office. You know, you don't make rules until you have somebody who's pushing the envelope such that they've gone over the deep end. And you start making rules and you end up with a problem.
Yes, correct, Your Honor. But here there was no effort to say, okay, here are the rules. Here's the new policy because of the problem we're having. This was all directed specifically and only at Ms. Rizzatello. So,
and nobody else.
Nobody else. All the others testified. We didn't have an attendance requirement. We could come and go as we pleased. That's the evidence of the other co-workers there, as well as an office manager. And also, Your Honor was asking about the citations or references to the medical record with regard to Ms. Rizzatello's inability. You will find citations at page 15 of my reply brief. Also, there was a question came up with respect to evidence that Mr. Wilson had a meeting or a conversation with HR on March 3, 1999. That is a critical juncture because there's discussion at that point about bringing in Ms. Rizzatello for a meeting to discuss her attendance issue. Well, there is absolutely no evidence that HR or Mr. Wilson ever did, in fact, bring in Ms. Rizzatello for any discussion. Quite to the contrary, what you have is, following that March 3, 1999 conversation with Human Resources, Mr. Wilson calls in Ms. Rizzatello, not for a meeting to discuss, but for a one-way meeting when he lays it out on her that you are now required to be here Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, no ifs, ands, or buts. Never inquired about her disability, never inquired about her health condition, never any opportunity to have a two-way discussion. Mr. Wilson admits this was a one-way conversation and not intended to be a friendly one either.
Did your client ever complain to Wilson about gender discrimination?
Yes. Yes, she complained, in fact, several times.
To Wilson. Now.
Yes. Yes, several times, beginning in September, when in terms of he accused Mr. Wilson of giving preferential treatment in the assignment of accounts in September of 98. In January of 99, he complained again to him giving preferential treatment to the mail brokers in terms of transferring his book of business to mails, never giving her the opportunity. And that's when she said, do I need to go to the EEOC to level the playing field here? You're giving preferential treatment to the mail brokers. And that's in writing.
And what happened after that?
That was January. That's when shortly after that is when he calls her in and then lays down the attendance policy for the first time. That all followed those complaints.
So what was that December 2nd, 1998 thing I was reading from before? That's evidence that occurred earlier?
Pardon, I didn't catch that, Your Honor.
And there's I'm having trouble following the numbers, but I think it's on page 96 of the excerpts. There's the deposition of Tal Wilson. It says, in your entry for December 2nd, 1998, it says, that he had a conversation where I said if she did not work within the standard office environment, I cannot supervise her activity. I guess the difference there is that he didn't lay down a particular amount of time. That's different. He told her to come in, but he didn't tell her how often. What happened?
I think there was some discrepancy in Mr. Wilson's testimony where the only thing that's clear that comes out is that January is the first time he actually is clear about this instruction for her to come in. Mr. Rizzitello has disputed that he ever raised this issue until January, and it was only after she had made those numerous complaints of discrimination.
Okay, I think we've covered everything.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
Matter of staying submitted. We come now to Los Angeles versus Alexander.
I would like to explain that I checked this morning and we had thought that we had sent out an order granting the motion to file the supplementary excerpts, but that order apparently did not go out, so I apologize for that. But it was the intent of the panel, as I understand it, to grant that motion.
Okay.
Thank you. Vivian Swanigan Crenshaw, Deputy City Attorney for the City of Los Angeles. I'd like to go straight to the court's concerns expressed in the order of October the 20th, which basically, the court's questions there emphasized the city's position in this matter, which is that the district court had no jurisdiction to award attorney's fees. The question of whether California Code of Civil Procedure Section 1021.5 authorizes fee awards in federal court cases that cover only federal court issues is basically determined by the fact that there are no cases where you get fees awarded under 1021.5 where there's only a federal issue. It's only raised in cases where there is a California issue. In this particular instance, there is not an issue related to California law, and that's because the motion to intervene of Hertz and Phillips was denied. The complaint and intervention that was lodged with the court was only lodged with the court. There was no ruling by the court.
It wasn't denied. It's just what they're acted upon, right?
The motion to intervene was denied by the court, by the district court.
As moot.
Oh, it's moot.
Yes, that's correct. It was denied. And so once it was denied, then that complaint that was lodged with the court had no relevance. It was never ruled upon. That complaint did
So you're really saying that the two pieces stand or fall together. I mean, if they were otherwise, if they were raising state law issues. And if they were otherwise entitled to fees as interveners, then they would be entitled to fees under 1021.5. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that if they had been granted intervener status and that complaint had been acted upon, which had California issues in it, then, yes, they would have been entitled to attorney's fees, and that's why the City of Los Angeles paid Alexander's attorney's fees in this matter and did not go forward with an appeal as to Alexander. But these two other applicants in intervention did not attain the same status that Alexander obtained when his motion to intervene was granted. Here you have two applicants in intervention who have no standing in this case, who the court had no jurisdiction to award attorney's fees. There is no California issue. They were not parties to the action. They were never parties to the action because their motion to intervene was never granted.
So the question, the answer to the question in the order comes back to whether they're parties in the first place.
Yes, it does come back to whether they're parties in the first place. And what the position is of the appellees in this matter, and indeed of the district court below also, is that when you're saying prevailing party in a 1988 action in federal court, that you have to be a party. In fact, the court says, the district court says in its May 20th, 2002 ruling that you have to be a party in order to be a prevailing party. But what the district court and appellees are saying is that somehow under California law,
California law is, to this point, different as to the catalyst question, and that
it definitely is different as to the catalyst question, but it's not different as to the party question. The catalyst question goes to whether or not you're successful, not to whether or not you're a party. You either are a party or you're not a party. The plain reading of that word, the plain meaning of the statute is you have to be a party to the action. Whether you're a catalyst or not goes to whether you're successful, okay, not to whether you're a party. And there's absolutely no reason to reinterpret that statute so that the word party basically isn't even in there.
Well, I mean, it's a strange situation. They were, at the time of the ruling, participants in the litigation to a limited degree. And they were certainly parties to a dispute, with the, other parties as to whether they were to be allowed in the case. So to that degree, they hadn't been admitted as full parties, but they were parties to something, i.e. a dispute over whether they ought to be allowed to intervene, right?
I would disagree with the court on that. They were not parties in any way, shape, or form. The fact that they went out and filed a summary judgment motion while they were not even interveners in the matter does not suddenly give you status. The fact that they came into court and made arguments when they were not given intervener status does not make you a party. If that were the case, people could come in all over the place while this case was sitting there on a stay between the United States and the city. You could have had all other applicants who would ever apply to be a firefighter in the year 2002, for example, could have all come in with their attorneys and filed a motion to intervene. And at the very end, when the city and the United States settled the matter between them, even though none of them had been granted intervener status, they could all get attorney's fees. And all these attorneys from all these different applicants and intervention could come in and, I'm going to file this kind of motion. I'm going to file that kind of motion. I'm going to come in and say this. I'm going to come in and say that. And everyone would get attorney's fees.
Well, it'd be up to the court.
That'd be a big boost to the economy, wouldn't it?
First of all, they're only going to get one set of attorney's fees, no matter what they get. And second of all, the court, obviously, who was close to the situation, did feel that this motion was the precipitating factor in getting the decision that was made. So essentially what you're saying is that he was forced to have to rule on the motion to intervene initially instead of just letting it ride and in recognition at the end that this was why the action came about as it did anyway.
You know, I have some sympathy for the district court in the sense that, as pointed out in Appellee's brief, the district court, and as pointed out by the district court in its rulings, the district court actually invited counsel for Appellee's to go and find some more clients and come back. You know, basically, when Alexander was let out of the action, as the district court explained in its rulings, the district court told them, well, Alexander's out of the action, but you go find some more clients and come on back here. And that's what they did.
The truth is, but the district court thinks of all these litigants as really shills for an organization which is really doing the work.
Yes.
Right?
And, yes,
and the question is whether we should look through it the same way and say, yep, they're just shills, and the real party here is the Individual Rights Foundation, and they're the ones who are going to get the money.
Well, except that by the time that the Rights Foundation came back with their new applicants for intervention, by the time that happened, as the district court also explains in its ruling, the district court had suggested to the United States and the city, why don't you two take a look at this why don't you two parties, you two remaining parties, take a look at this consent decree and decide, do you really need this thing to go on? And the court stayed the matter. So that by the time the applicants and intervention came back and reappeared, the invited applicants for intervention came back, now the United States and the city were already on the road to what happened, which was the elimination of the consent decree. So at that point, the district court said, I don't need to have you intervene in the matter.
He didn't say that. He just didn't say that at all.
He didn't rule on it right then.
That's right.
So he put it over because it might be moot. And then in the end, when it came back up again, when we were back in front of the district court said, you know, It is moot. Don't need you as an intervener in this matter. Now, the fact that the attorneys went out during this stay period and filed summary judgment motions and did all other sorts of things and came into court and filed paper after paper after paper after paper does not translate you into a party. And it does not suddenly make what is a federal case into a state court case when your complaint and intervention is never even filed with the court, only lodged according to the court docket. The city's position is that the court did not have jurisdiction to give the attorney's fees because Hurst and Phillips were not interveners. They were not a party. There was no complaint filed. There was no complaint ruled on. There's no 1021.5 claim, and there should be no fees given. And I would like to...
I have one question. The California Supreme Court has granted a petition for review on whether it is going to follow the Supreme Court's Buchanan opinion as to catalyst fees in general. What is the advisability of our waiting for that decision rather than deciding the case at this time?
As far as I'm aware, that does not go to the issue of a party. Again, that goes...
very clear, but it could certainly throw some light on it, I would suppose, depending on how they outline the parameters of the catalyst decision theory if it continues to exist.
Well, the position I would take is that's a little speculative. The issue of whether one is a party or not is that such a basic... basically looking at the face of the statute that was passed by the California legislature, the word party does not mean something different than it means in 1988 actions in federal court. You're either a party or you're not a party, and I don't think that there's any reason for the California Supreme Court in that appeal that you're referring to even discuss that because it's such a basic notion. I'd like to reserve the remaining time if there's no further questions at this time.
Fine.
May it please the Court, Manuel Posner, on behalf of the appellees and the movements for intervention below, and Pat Mansart is here with me as well. I guess we're at the end of the calendar here, and I think we have an interesting case that I'd like to start off by observing that I think we had a very careful trial judge below who really had lived with this case ever since the underlying consent decree litigation was assigned to him. No activity had occurred in that case below until we came in representing initially David Alexander. And the chronology is, I think, useful to help put into sharper profile what happened, why we did what we did, what impact our efforts had, and why that led Judge Hupp ultimately in his series of rulings to award certain of the fees that we had sought and deny other fees that we had sought. The chronology starts with our first complaint that was brought in, it was a collateral attack on the decree, and that was filed it was a case that was assigned to Judge Wilson in April 2001, and that was brought by David Alexander. David Alexander afterwards moved I actually gave the wrong date. He brought it before April 2001. He came in originally in September of 2000, raising a collateral attack on the constitutionality of the 1974 decree and seeking other relief. The September 2000 action was limited by Judge Wilson. It was very fiercely opposed by the city and the federal government. And in the opposition, there was a series of efforts made to dismiss or derail that case. And eventually, the city defendants were effective in paring the case down somewhat. But not entirely. We felt at the time that we had urged, this is not on the record, so I'm going to be careful in how I frame this, but the record does show we did everything we could as a matter of record to put the city defendants on notice as there's a significant problem here with a decree that is not only an ancient, obsolescent decree, totally anachronistic, causing all kinds of distortions, but it was, we felt on its face, it was transparently unconstitutional. There were never any findings. The law had changed since the original decree had been entered. The demographics of the city had changed.
Well, Alexander is part of it.
This is Alexander. This is originally Dave Alexander.
Yes.
Dave Alexander, the city, we had hoped that because livelihoods were at stake on behalf of our clients and other applicants, not just white applicants, minority applicants who were seeking a job that they were had a career goal of achieving, a job as a firefighter with the city, they were finding that because of the residency requirement, no matter how well qualified they were, this happened with Mr. Phillips, it happened with Dave Alexander, they were disqualified in residency. It happened to a number of minorities as well. It didn't matter how qualified they were because they had to be a resident.
Well, it's very interesting. The point is, this is while Alexander is there. He kicks it off. He gets things moving.
Right.
All right.
Then what
then,
happens?
Then he drops out. Because he gets a job offer, so he's gone.
And fees are paid.
Dave Alexander is dismissed. His complaint is dismissed as moot. And he's, because he had settled his case.
Right, so he's out.
All right, now that happens in, he is out in, August of 2001. August 2001. Dave Alexander's out. Judge Hupp invites us, as counsel for the city indicated, if we can come back with some other parties, we should do that. And I do have a comment I'd like to make, Judge Fernandez, and that is the word shill is somewhat pejorative. This is a public interest case in the fullest and finest sense of the word. This is a case that's seeking to achieve fundamental rights.
I'm talking about the district court's looking at it as if you folks are the litigants.
You know, Your Honor, I would say that that was part of the reality. And it's one thing about the difference in state law between federal law. It's not just an issue of catalyst. We know, but of course, in this respect, federal and state law are identical. The attorney's fees claim is a claim directly that goes to attorneys. It doesn't have to go to the clients. And in this unusual situation, what the court told us in the in-bank decision in the state Supreme Court in Serrano versus Priest, which is not distinct from federal law, this can be a direct claim for lawyer's fees by the Individual Rights Foundation and its counsel. And the paradox is,
but you still need to have a client. I mean, all right, so but just let's go through the sequence here. So then you filed a state court case at some point for Hirst and Phillips, right?
That's right. We filed a state court case feeling everything that we did was opposed, and we felt this was a classic pattern of stall, delay, and derail. And no matter what we
ever did. Right, so, and that case was removed to federal court.
That action was removed to federal court, and
then you also intervened into this case.
That's correct. We had the motions to intervene, which were not granted, but the motions to intervene.
And motions, I'm sorry.
That's right. Filed by Hirst and Phillips. That was in September of 2001.
What happened to the other case?
The other litigation is still pending, and it's actually, we had a mediation last week in the case, and we're still trying to negotiate a settlement at this stage. Now that the decree is history and was vacated by Judge Hupp, we're now trying to resolve the few loose threads that are still existing in these in litigation that we did not anticipate would be as widespread and far-reaching. Now, I might mention, for what it's worth, there were no fees that were awarded in the removal case. There's been a lot of hours that have been expended. We feel that was directly expended for the purpose of achieving the public interest result, the public benefit that was ultimately enjoyed, that Judge Hupp understood when...
Since it was our error in not having the order issued, I understand why we don't have the complaint and intervention, the proposed complaint and intervention. But can you tell me briefly what the state law question that was raised in that complaint is?
We raised questions under Prop 209, Proposition 209, which is part of the state constitution now. We raised questions under the state federal Fair Employment and Housing Act.
This is what I'm having trouble with. How could either of those state causes of action trump an otherwise proper federal consent decree if it was proper under federal law?
The question is a very good one. We have two answers to it. Our analysis was twofold. Number one, because there were no findings to support the original decree in 1974, and it's part of the record in this case that Judge Leidick thought that this was as thin a case he's ever seen. He would have granted the motion for summary judgment to get the city out, but it was shortly after the mayoral election, and Bert Pines was then the city attorney, that the city worked out a settlement, even though it looked like a case that should have not been filed by the federal government. But there were political considerations that were involved. I just lost my thread for a second there, Your Honor. Just Barzin,
I'm just trying to find out why. I mean, some state law questions to attack a federal
sentence
frame. And only for that reason are you getting attorney fees. Quite aside from all the party business, it seems to me that one would have to have some reason to believe that your state law claims were not frivolous, and I find it hard to see, and you were trying to help me see, why a state law cause of action would invalidate a federal consent decree if it was otherwise valid under federal law.
All right. There are two aspects. Number one is, as Judge Hupp eventually found in one of his rulings in the case, because there were no findings, in 1974, when the decree was entered, the decree itself had very limited adjudicative value. We felt that under Prop 209, that while Prop 209 has an exemption as the supremacy clause otherwise itself would call for, that a valid consent decree could not be challenged under Prop 209, notwithstanding there was the issue, the underlying question was, is a valid consent decree? And Judge Hupp himself found that it did not have preclusive effect, that the underlying, because of the lack of findings under the, I think it was the City of Chicago Heights case, Judge Hupp said, this is very limited, it's like an agreement.
Well, that's a different issue. I mean, that may give you a separate cause of action to 209, but why does it lead to invalidating the consent decree?
Well, if it's like just an agreement,
how does state law trump a federal consent decree?
If it's transparent, two answers just to round out the first point I was making. If the decree was transparently invalid, which we felt it did for the lack of findings, we cited Crawford versus Honig, which is a case that the Ninth Circuit ruled and affirmed a ruling of Judge Peckham involving. Litigation involving
counsel, we ask a very direct question. We get all the circumlocution. Just make it.
How could state law? My simple answer is: we believed it was transparently invalid. That Crawford versus Honig said under Rule 60.
You believe the federal decree was so transparently invalid that any law could knock it out because it didn't even exist, basically.
It was one argument we had, and I think it was a valid argument. We had a second argument. The second argument was that the decree itself, we were challenging two aspects. We were challenging racial preferences that were engaged in by the city. The city, under the consent decree, but the city itself has taken the position in the litigation that under the consent decree, there was only one moment where race properly could be used under the consent decree, and that was dealing with the so-called interest cards. The procedure basically was people wanted a job as a firefighter. They had to go to the personnel department, get a interest card, let people, let the city know they're interested. They would be called then when the next examination was going to be given. But if there were not enough minorities to fulfill the interim hiring goals, then whites would be delayed. They would be deferred. This was the only place under the decree that the city claims was the only proper place for race to be used. Our view was that race was being used in other ways not sanctioned by the decree. So we had...
So then you have another lawsuit. But why is that underlining consent decree?
I'm sorry, I missed
the question. Then you have another lawsuit. But why does that undermine a consent decree?
Well, the other point was we're also seeking to stop the discriminatory practice by the city.
Fine. Then you have another lawsuit. I'm having a very hard time seeing why anything that's in your non-admitted complaint and intervention could have, in any non-frivolous way, implicated this consent decree. Anything about state law. Now, I haven't seen the complaint and intervention. There may be federal law questions, and they may be legitimate ones, but they're not going to support the attorney's thing.
Well, I guess my answer is, I think we had really, these were serious meritorious issues that we had analyzed. We didn't know. We thought that the city would capitulate immediately because of there were a lot of good reasons once we originally filed the complaint for Dave Alexander. If there are no findings, this is, and Judge Huff has found this now under, he agreed under City of Chicago Heights, a consent decree is not immunized from state law challenges by the Supremacy Clause if there are no findings to support it.
No, it would not immunize them against state law challenges. That doesn't answer why intervention here, which was never granted, makes you a party to this case.
Of course, we were raising obviously the federal claims as well. So it was we were
sure,
putting a lot of ammunition there on the concept. We Judge Kopp early on said that we had raised serious questions that are worthy of consideration by the state and federal government, the city and federal government.
When Mr. Alexander was part of
when
it.
When Mr. Alexander was a party, notwithstanding.
And there were fees awarded for what you did for Mr. Alexander.
That is correct.
And
that is
those
correct.
Aren't on appeal.
They were initially, but that was dismissed. That's correct.
But in fact, the Alexander fees would be similarly, if we were to rule that an intervener who hasn't been granted party status can't get fees under 1021.5, then Alexander couldn't have gotten the fees out of it. They chose to pay them, but the issue is the same, no?
I think there is that issue. Here I would turn, Your Honor, to the third question that was put to counsel in the order that was sent a couple of weeks ago to us, and that is, what are the issues on appeal that have not been waived? This issue was not raised by the appeal.
I understand it wasn't, but I'm asking you conceptually, was Alexander's motion to intervene ever granted?
Yes, Alexander, he was granted intervention status, and then his status was dismissed. His complaint intervention was dismissed as moot.
Okay, he was granted intervention status, so I'm wrong about that. So that's why he's different.
He was an intervention. But I would also make this comment. Look, the opposing counsel in describing the chronology, I believe, misstated the sequence. The U.S.
Let me ask you, it would be more helpful to me at this point to get it to a slightly higher level of abstraction. What would you suggest is your argument that he's a party because he was, he filed a motion to intervene? What if he'd written a letter saying, I'm going to file a motion to intervene, but didn't? I mean, at what point does this cut off?
Mm-hmm. And then we're talking not just the he, but it's, both Hurst and Phillips.
You're claiming they're parties to what?
Right.
And what made them parties?
All right. I think what made him a party, let me give you this analysis. The language of the state statute, 1021.5, calls for a successful party to be entitled to fees. And the question is, how do we compare that with prevailing party under the federal statutes? And the answer, as we know, is it isn't the same. Federal rulings are persuasive but not governing. Our view is this, that the actual litigant as judge, and this is an unusual case I want to emphasize. Judge Hupp put it very well. The catalyst that he found was Alexander, Hearst, Phillips, the Individual Rights Foundation, and its lawyers. It was part of this full court press that we felt we needed, and here's where the chronology becomes important. The city and the federal government did nothing except stall and delay and try to derail and knock us out, even after we filed after Dave Alexander was dismissed. We felt, our people were running out of time. They wanted jobs. They're getting older. How long can this go on? 2 years. It took 2 years.
You're not answering my question at all. I mean, I don't want a fact-specific answer. I want to know what rule we're looking at here.
All right. Well, here's my analysis is, it's under the state statute. It's under 1021.5. The language says a successful party. What does that mean is our issue. And we argue successful party, as the city concedes in its brief, the words party under state law either mean the litigant or the lawyer for the litigant. We take that a step further. We agree with that. And we take it a step further and say, as in the Schmier case versus the California Supreme Court that we cited and others, that the litigant or the litigant's attorney also is, in the context of this analysis, the same as the language used in Schmier, was a fee claimant. The lawyer becomes a fee claimant. We believe, under the beneficial and broad policy considerations underlying 1021.5, it's within the sound discretion of the trial judge to say that if you have a combination, evolution, and our efforts as lawyers for Dave Alexander would have been interrupted, nothing would have continued. Judge Hupp, the order that Judge Hupp's granting us fees for Dave Alexander was an order that came after the tentative ruling denying fees for Dave Alexander.
Isn't it true under California law that let's say that somebody writes a letter to a state agency and says a very long letter, and attaches a complaint and says, this is my legal problem, here's my complaint, I'm going to file it 3 days from now unless you do something. If the state then does something, they can't get 1021.5 fees before the case is filed. Is that true?
Unfortunately, because of the sound, I missed part of the question.
That's correct. Let me give you my hypothetical again.
What if you never filed just a letter? Yeah, okay. I think
a long letter, a demand letter. They attach a complaint. They say, we're filing this complaint next week unless you do X for us. The state then does X for them. Do they get 1021.5 fees if they never file a lawsuit?
My answer is we don't have to reach that here. I think that's very distinguishable from our case. I don't think that's the same, but I could see in a very...
Can't you just answer the question?
I would say a court, I think, could award fees in that situation, but I think it's a very different case.
I thought the state law was fairly clear that you can't. You have to be a party to a lawsuit, to something.
We know there's authority we haven't cited in our briefs in various states where you can get fees for
this
work.
State. We're in this state. We're not in a different state.
All right. Well, I don't have any authority to that effect, Your Honor, and I couldn't say that that's California law. I do feel that California law does sanction our situation because we were in front of the court. The court, contrary to what the city says, that there's no jurisdiction, there indeed is jurisdiction. It's a question whether there was an abuse of discretion.
What you're really saying is that the lawyers in this situation are the parties.
The lawyers, in effect, are tantamount to the parties because they have the direct claim for fees. They become the fee claimants. That's part of the law.
They come into court without a client, and that client wasn't admitted as a party in the case.
Well, but we, I, again, I think, look, unless, if I'm correct, that unless there's a manifest exercise of abuse of discretion, that just causes some manifest injustice, and the circumstances of this case, if we look at our standard of review, what are we talking about? Judge Huff was very close to it. He's not a crazy guy. And he's looking and seeing what happened. His original view was, Dave Alexander was out of the case, shouldn't get an award of fees for that time, and it should only go to Hearst and Phillips for the effort their lawyers made there. You know, you kind of get boxed in, and you can analyze this in ways that you can raise.
It sounds like you could have, but did not, explain this problem to Judge Huff and say you need to rule on the motion to intervene.
If you'd ruled on that, you wouldn't have been here.
The answer is that is true. And we did actually raise in front of Judge Huff, we made an attempt to ask him to file, to do a motion non-proton, so we would avoid this whole issue. So we didn't, because we realized it's not 100% clear. We thought if the judge would give us fees, it would be sustained because of the abuse of discretion standard, but we didn't even want to wait a year to have to get our fees. So we did file, but Judge Huff just said, no, I've made an order. I ruled on the motion to intervene after I vacated the decree. And so we made an effort. And
you didn't alert him to the problem earlier on.
Yeah, I mean, look, originally, we weren't sure what was going to happen with the case. The city, if I could just return a little bit to the chronology, because I think looking at it from the view from our foxholes that we were in, we were trying to get the city and the
hill. These are your foxholes on Bunker Hill, huh?
Foxholes on Bunker Hill. Well, you know, the hill's been carved down a lot, and we're at the foot of the hill, so there was a lot of ammunition coming over in our direction from the federal and city government. If there was a motion that could have been made, I can't think of any that wasn't made to knock us out. And so we were there instead of.
Counselor, you're sort of repeating, and we're over your time.
Yeah, we're over the time, and
all right,
we're repeating what you've already told us.
All right, I guess we got
your picture pretty well in hand.
All right. Well, if I could simply say chronologically, we made our effort. We brought our motions to intervene prior to the city and federal government moving to vacate, and indeed their response to it. Their response to it was to file a joint motion asking for 6 months to stay the case. I'm just saying, under those circumstances, Judge Huff saw all of this. Judge Huff gave them, we opposed 6 months.
But there's a technical problem here, which is whether you're legally entitled to fees under the statute, and you've given us really not much help on that.
I think the analysis that I've given on an abuse of discretion standpoint is more than ample help, I would hope, because if the lawyers, as we have under state law, a direct claim for fees, number one. Number two, under the case law in California, including Schmier and other cases, a fee claimant, the court talks in terms of fee claimant, not just a litigant or a successful party. So the question is, how broad is the term used under California law? We know the city itself concedes that the party doesn't mean just party. It also includes the litigant's attorney. So the case, that's our analysis. I think there's more than enough in the record here on the standard of review that applies to say this, the Judge Huff was correct. No abuse of discretion. It would be a manifest injustice to reverse, and this order should be affirmed.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anything further from the city?
Nothing further
unless... I have two questions.
Okay.
First of all, what do you have represented that the Ninth Circuit law under federal law is that people who are unsuccessful interveners don't get fees, but what do you do with the In re Bening case? That's my first question.
I'm not getting the question.
What do you do with the In re Bening case in the Ninth Circuit with regard to federal law? Which did grant fees to an unsuccessful intervener on the ground that they participated as amicus and were in every respect except the formal designation as parties were the real parties in interest in the decision on the constitutionality of the statute. And my second question is goes back to the issue of the pending California Supreme Court case and whether it is at least relevant on the question of the degree to which the state courts will continue to follow federal law.
Can you repeat for me again the name of the case?
In Re Benny, B-E-N-N-Y, 81 F. 3rd, 91. I don't remember if it was in the brief.
I don't believe that I'm familiar with that case.
Okay, if you're not, then you can't answer, so.
The third case and the Buell case, both interveners are denied as because they are not prevailing parties. That's under 1988. In those two cases, the court found.
Right. Benny was afterwards, and that's why I want you to address it. And the second question is, well, the second question is less important, so if you have nothing else to say, why don't we just end? Thank you.
Okay. There is one additional thing. The appellees seem to be working under the theory that basically the city was informed there was a problem with the consent decree that didn't move fast enough, and so this makes the applicants and intervention a catalyst because they were basically waiting in the wings and in case, you know, the city and didn't move fast enough or the United States didn't move fast enough. But that, again, does not go to the issue of whether or not they are parties. And in this particular case, the city, in the 4-month stay that the district court granted, the city and the United States spent that time trying to reach a conclusion. The two sides obviously did not conclude, as you can see by the record. The United States made one motion to modify the consent decree. The city made a different motion to modify the consent decree. The city's motion to modify the consent decree was basically dissolving this consent decree. The city's motion was granted, and basically the reward that the city got for working diligently and you know, never being able to get anywhere with the United States was the United States running off, you know, free and clear, and the city being charged with all this extra work that applicants and intervention did in the meantime that was really unnecessary in the end.
Okay. Thank you. Court will recess until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning. All matters that we heard today are submitted.